You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
At the center of Stuart Onan's latest novel, Songs for the Missing, is Kim Larson, an Ohio teenager who disappears one night without a trace. But Kim isn't the real focus of Mr. Onan's story. Rather, it's her family and friends who are forced to go about their daily activities as weeks and then months drag by without any clues. This novel, Stuart Onan's 12th, is published by Viking, and I'm pleased that it brings him back to the show today. Hello.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
There have been a lot of books, movies, TV shows written about missing children. They've often been criticized for being overly sentimental and melodramatic. That is a problem, isn't it, in dealing with something like this?
Well, the subject material is so loaded. You have to be very careful, and yet you can't sort of be too cool or too calm with it. Otherwise, you end up being very sterile.
So how do you walk that narrow line?
Well, it's been my technique in the last few books just to stay close to the characters, be very intimate with them, and watch them in their most unguarded moments and try to find out those moments that are most important to them and moments that they would remember maybe forever.
I've heard that you've been thinking about this situation for quite a while now, and it's taken you all this time to figure out how to make it work. What got you involved in thinking about it in the first place?
Well, I've been looking back at sort of my life and trying to figure out where this interest in the missing person comes from.
Because you had an earlier novel, I think, was it the Good Wife, in which a husband goes away for 28 years to prison.
And in Snow Angels also, there's a search for a missing small child there. And when I was 17 years old, I was working at a camp up on Lake Erie in the northeastern corner of Ohio. And one night at about 4 in the morning, the police came to the door of our sort of dormitory where the counselors slept, and they said, "We need your help. There's been an accident down the road, and we found the car, and it's empty, and there's blood all over it, and we need to find the people that were in the car." So we put on our clothes and our sneakers and grabbed our flashlights and went out there and searched through the dark woods, you know, in the middle of nowhere, sort of hoping not to find these people. And I think that has just sort of stuck with me, you know, my entire life. And that was, you know, 30 years ago.
But you had this idea for this book. You couldn't figure out how to make it work. There have been other books since. It's just been sitting at the back of your head?
Yeah, that's common with me. And it usually takes me a while to figure out what the best treatment is of the material, where the story really is. When I first started the book, the story was about the girl and about what happened to her. And it was seen from sort of a police procedural angle from a sheriff whose life had been this town. You know, he was the sheriff. He was the upholder of justice and law and all that, and sort of things fell apart for him. And I had mapped that onto the story, when the story really was about the people that miss this person, the mother, the father, the sister, the best friend, the boyfriend. That seemed to me really the most important thing, and the question of how well we know each other, and sometimes the pain of not being known, of being misunderstood by the people closest to us.
So in researching something like this, I've heard, followed several actual missing persons cases involving young women about Kim's age, and then you read a lot of blogs written by parents, siblings, and friends.
And sadly, a friend of mine, her partner's mother went missing right around this time as well. And that case ended unhappily as well. And so to see it so far from the inside and understand what people go through day by day, month by month, year by year, that gave me sort of a whole different view of it than we normally see sort of in the paper or on 2020 or Without a Trace or CSI.
Well, how long do most people continue to hold out hope that they'll find a missing child when there's no news for years and years?
Some never give it up. Some go to their graves never having given up hope. And people grieve at very different rates. And in this case, Fran has to hold on to hope. She does everything possible to bring Kim back.
Fran is the mother.
Fran, the mother, yeah. And she takes that sort of proactive, very public role, whereas Ed retreats. He's a much more private person, and I think he gives up a little too early, and Fran holds that against him.
Well, Fran does all sorts of things like creates events that remind people that Kim is missing, whereas Ed is a guy who's used to being in control, and since he can't control the police procedures, he would give up eventually.
He kind of absents himself from the process, whereas Fran makes herself utterly present, becomes almost this sort of super spokesperson. And Fran doesn't understand why Ed is doing what he's doing, and Ed doesn't understand what Fran is doing, what she's doing. And yet, because of who they are, they somehow stay together, because that's something that can really tear a family apart.
Kim is 18 years old in July 2005 when the novel begins. She's finished high school, is counting the days until she leaves for college, and she's got a job that brings her home rather late at night. And you tell the story from a lot of different viewpoints so that we can learn about her in ways that each of the characters might not have known themselves.
Yeah, and Kim has she has a lot of different sides to her. She's only 18, so she hasn't really become the person that she wants to become. And she's a very difficult person in some respects. And so everyone has their own Kim, and they can't quite figure out who she was.
In fact, Kim's friends, JP and Nina, know a very different Kim than her parents know.
And that separation between the worlds of teenagers and the worlds of adults comes into play again, as it did in my first book, Snow Angels, or in The Night Country, and the lies that we tell and the secrets that we keep, again, from the people closest to us. Fran has lived with Kim's entire life, and yet when the detective sits down with her to find out some very basic things about Kim, Fran feels like she's being evasive because she doesn't really know.
Especially about Kim's her dating life, I don't know how to say that, but her sexual life.
Her romantic life, her life away from the house, she doesn't quite know her. And Lindsay knows a very different Kim, and JP, of course, knows a very different Kim.
My guest is Stuart Onan, whose latest novel is Songs for the Missing. It is published by Viking. The Economist called this an elegantly crafted, memorable book that resonates with sadness. And you've written a number of books that resonate with sadness, going all the way back to Snow Angels. Is there something about resonating with sadness that is at the basis of your whole writing philosophy or the way you see the world?
Is it a tragic view of life? It may be. It may be, I think. There's very little great literature written about happy people, I think, right?
Tolstoy started off with that, and then he dismissed the happy family and went on to the other stuff.
That's right, the more interesting people. You know, I try to find stories that I think have been sort of glossed over, that we may think we know the story, but we really don't know the story. So it's always looking for the story behind the story or the untold story.
And as you're writing this and as you're thinking about how these people are going to evolve, in the case of Fran, into some pretty silly things at times, fundraisers and the like. You even wonder whether she cares whether what she does will produce any results. It's maybe more for her than it is for finding Kim.
Yeah, there's a busyness that she has to sort of, she has to keep busy, she has to keep doing these things. And Ed certainly doesn't understand her frantic, frantic pace, but she thinks this is the only way that she's going to get Kim back, and she's going to use every possible opportunity, especially when it comes to the media.
Well, the reader wonders what I would do. I wonder what I would do if I were in their place, especially in Fran's place, and I might very well do some of these things, even if they were totally useless.
You'll do anything. You'll do anything you can to get your child back. And again, this book, like The Good Wife or Last Night at the Lobster, I'm trying to let the reader into how it would really feel to be this person in this situation.
It becomes more difficult for Kim's family and friends to cope as time passes. I'm not going to give away the ending, of course. And you must be pleased that nobody has in any of the reviews. Often that is a problem for a writer, isn't it?
I suppose it is if the book were really sort of dependent on the ending. And I think in the way that this looks at its characters, the way that it looks at its people and their lives, that really the best part of the book to me, and the last few books have been like this, I think the middle of the book is really the heart of the book. It's these people trying to live their lives in this impossible circumstance.
Now, you live in Connecticut. Why did you set the story in Ohio?
I've always been fascinated by that corner of Ohio. I've been going there for the last 40 years. There's a camp up there that my family is associated with. My brother's on the board of the camp. And it's a beautiful part of the country, and I'd never seen much written about it at all. And I think it's fascinating. The small town there, especially Conneaut, Ohio, Kingsville, and Ashtabula, they're going through some economic hard times and have been for the past 25, 30 years. But still, it's a fascinating place.
Were the residents of a small town in another part of the country, like where you live in Connecticut, have reacted differently to a tragedy like Kim's disappearance?
I think so. I think that the people around that area are much more conservative, much more staid. I think, as in the case of the Good Wife, Patty reacts to her loss in the way that this is the world that she knows, and this is the world that she counts on. It's always going to be that way.
Now, in The Good Wife, we also have a situation where a husband is arrested for robbery and murder, and his wife doesn't know about his life as a criminal, partly because she's in a state of denial, but partly because we only know what we're allowed to know about people. And that's part of the plot here as well.
Yeah, and I think it's true of the other books that I've written as well, that there's a line, you can only know someone so much there.
Now, this book, you say, was quite a few years in the making. It's sitting there gestating at the back of your brain. Is there another book that's been gestating that you're starting to see a way of handling?
No, not one that I can sort of consciously say. I'm working on another book right now. It's actually a sequel to Wish You Were Here, which is a very large book about a family, sort of a family saga, and of a lake cabin that has to be sold. It's the book that my wife calls the big boring book. So I'm writing a sequel to the big boring book. But who knows? I mean, you're always taking notes. You're always cutting things out of the newspaper and putting them away. And you never know. At least I never know quite what I'm going to write next.
Well, you've written two works of nonfiction. You've had short story collections. So how do you determine whether you're going to put all your energy into this or that?
What you become fascinated by. You know, you go with the very hot, hot item. When I was beginning this book about 10 years ago, another character came through this little town I was writing about, and suddenly I became fascinated with this woman in her late 60s and the people around her, and she took me off on, you know, a 3.5-year trip to do a whole different kind of book. So, I mean, you're always going to be surprised. You hope you're going to be surprised. If you're not surprised by what you're writing, you're in trouble.
That surprises me that I've heard writers talk about how a character suddenly comes into a book and changes the whole tone of the book, but not becomes another book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's very common with me. I think I'm going to be writing this one thing, and then, you know, 100, 200 pages into it, someone sort of like zips across and becomes the focus there. And that's you know, the ideal.
Stuart Onan is the author of 12 novels, including the latest one, Songs for the Missing, but we're also talking about Snow Angels, which was made into a film recently, A Prayer for the Dying. There's a story collection, two works of nonfiction. This book is published by Viking, and it is my great pleasure to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you.